For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. Today we're going to be talking about conversion practices and how health practitioners can help their LGBTQA plus patients who are survivors.
Conversion practices introduce a fundamental conflict between a person's belonging with their religious or cultural community and their gendered or sexual sense of self. And for many people, this deep conflict between core parts of themselves is completely disabling.
That's Associate Professor Tim Jones, an historian and social researcher with the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University. He and his colleague, Associate Professor Jennifer Power, are co-authors of A Perspective for the MJA. Their research tells them that health practitioners often lack confidence in talking with their LGBTQA patients about sexuality, gender diversity, religion, and culture, and how those factors can interact. Tim and Jennifer are my special guests today. What is a conversion practice, and how does it differ from conversion therapy, if it does at all?
So a conversion practice, as it applies to same-sex attracted or gender-diverse people, or even people who identify as asexual, is really any attempt to change or suppress their sexuality or their gender identity. So this can include a whole range of practices. They sometimes look like therapy, so it might be something like a therapeutic group, a group that's similar perhaps in form or culture to something like Alcoholics Anonymous. It might be more prayer groups, or it might be very informal sort of practices that are really reiterating the message that a person is broken or damaged because of their sexual identity or their gender identity, and that they can be fixed through religious processes or prayer processes of prayer or processes of sort of pseudo-psychotherapy. And it differs from what we often think of as conversion therapy. And I think that's largely because there's these quite Hollywood images of conversion therapy. I think people imagine something like, you know, electroshock therapy or sort of aversion therapy that we might have heard of from the 50s, or more kind of extreme sexual change camps or sort of particular therapeutic practices. But in actual fact, it's much more common for conversion practices to be quite informal, but it's really practices oriented around that message that someone's broken or damaged and in need of healing because of their sexuality or gender identity.
Do we have any idea about how many Australians may have had exposure to conversion practices?
Not really. Like it's actually a really difficult figure to calculate for reasons you might imagine. Firstly, you know, it's quite difficult to get any kind of population estimates relating to LGBTQA plus communities, even with respect to things like health and well-being. You know, it's difficult to get population-based data. We do estimate that possibly around 10% of Australians are involved in some sort of religious or cultural groups that promote some of the ideas behind conversion practices. We're not quite sure how that equates to the number of LGBTQA plus people exposed to conversion practices. We are about to launch a national survey to try and get a better sense of some of these figures. So really a national survey of religious experiences, both positive and negative and challenging and difficult and important to people. And we might try and get a sense of how many people have experienced conversion practices.
Yeah, there are a number of international surveys in the UK, in Canada and the US that have come up with a similar statistics between 5 and 15% of the general population having been exposed to conversion practices. And for minority cultural and gender populations, the figures are much higher, sometimes up 40% of some populations being exposed to conversion practices. We're just going on qualitative data in Australia, and we're really looking forward to getting the survey results.
Is there any evidence at all of benefit? In other words, I'm guessing successful permanent conversions, happy conversions?
No, there's not.
There's no evidence at all that conversion practices lead to the reorientation of a person's sexuality or gender identity. Small number of studies that do report change, but what they're reporting is changes in the expression of a person's sexuality or gender identity, but not their orientation or gendered sense of self. So those changes in behaviour can occur, but that's not actually a change of self.
So some of the benefits that people look for are celibacy. So, you know, some people might report a benefit
right.
if what the conversion practice has done is encourage someone to be celibate and to not have love in their life.
What are the harms? I mean, obviously, if there's no benefits, there must be harms. What are the harms associated with conversion practices?
International studies over the last 20 years have shown a wide variety of mental health problems associated with conversion practices, very, very high rates of suicidality. Our research with survivors and with treating mental health practitioners showed that conversion practices are associated with chronic, complex PTSD type symptoms. Most of the international studies have looked at the symptoms. Our recent research has been going a little bit deeper. Conversion practices introduce a fundamental conflict between a person's belonging with their religious or cultural community and their gendered or sexual sense of self.
Yes.
And for many people, this deep conflict between core parts of themselves is completely disabling.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to harm to development of their self-concept, their participation in life. Lots of our participants said they felt like they couldn't start their life until they had fixed themselves. So that delayed education, employment, engagement in civil society. And what no other study has really looked at, and what we've been looking at as well, is the spiritual harms associated with conversion practices. So people report damage to their ability to find existential meaning in the world, damage to their relationship with their spiritual community, their cultural community, and damage to their relationship with God, or their understanding of the spiritual world, depending on what background they come from.
Are conversion practices usually based in religious beliefs?
Yeah, so in Australia, most conversion practices are associated with religious groups. In some contexts around the world where diverse sexual orientation and gender identities are highly stigmatised, conversion practices are sometimes state-sanctioned, or where there are religious states, so places like Iran, Malaysia, China, for example, there are state-sponsored conversion practices. But in Australia, it's primarily in religious communities and religious-motivated individuals. One exception to that could be the difficulties that trans and gender-diverse people have in accessing affirmative healthcare. So sometimes the health practitioners who aren't confident in supporting trans and gender-diverse people, some of those practices might shift into the territory of encouraging gender-diverse people to change or suppress their gender diversity into more cis-normative ways of being.
And this is where we come to your article for the MJA, where you're talking about physicians needing some education and training in order to help best support survivors of conversion practices. Is that a fair assessment?
In the interviews that we did with people with lived experience of conversion practices, they frequently told us that it was really difficult to find supportive healthcare. Very often they'd speak to a GP or go to a mental health practitioner, and the mental health practitioner had their understanding of conversion practices from those Hollywood depictions and had a very simple understanding of what was required to resolve it. So just like, come out as queer and leave your religion behind, like a very simple thing. Tragically, that message reinforces the message of conversion practices that being queer and having faith or belonging to a minority cultural community are incompatible. And so, yeah, so there's a great need for health practitioners in Australia to get better at supporting sexually diverse people, gender diverse people, and people from minority religious and cultural traditions.
The other thing we're really calling for is just an enhanced awareness of what conversion practices are and what they look like. So we're very cognizant that GPs are kind of expected to know everything, and everyone's always calling for more training for GPs, and it's a tough gig. So really part of what we want to do is make sure training's available for GPs that do want to understand more about how to support patients who might be coming to them, or, you know, how to address or deal with these issues if it comes up, say, in a mental health assessment. But also really, you know, the point of the article that we have in the MJA is really just giving people some deeper understanding of what might have gone on for someone, you know, what someone might not be sort of saying or articulating in a consultation, or just having a deeper understanding of the issues. And I think that in itself will be important for GPs.
Are there resources online a GP can go to find some information and some training?
So there are two reports on the La Trobe website related to these issues. So if people wanted to look up the most recent one, it's called Healing Spiritual Harms. There's also what called the SOGI Survivor Statement, which is actually available in the reference list from the MJA article. There's a link.
I'm chatting with Tim Jones and Jennifer Power from the Australian Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University about conversion practices and how health practitioners can help their LGBTQA plus patients who are survivors. Their paper is open access and available at mja.com.au. The full link is in the show notes to this podcast. You will also find a couple of links to resources for doctors who want to learn more. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can sign up for more episodes by subscribing to our feed through Apple Music, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Audible. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and push the subscribe button. You can find all our earlier episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat. Do queer and gender diverse people seek out conversion practices on their own?
Most often, the majority of participants in our research either grew up in or joined religious and cultural communities where the message that the only right way to be is heterosexual and cisgender was so profound that they grew up believing that. And when they felt an emerging sense of diversity in their sexuality or gender identity, went to look for it themselves. Minority of participants were coerced or tricked by parents or members of their community into engaging in practices.
Should this be something GPs actively ask their queer patients about, or is it something you just don't mention until the patient brings it up?
There's a real problem with silence around this. Most people who have experience of conversion practices carry a lot of shame about those practices. And so they will present seeking for help with the symptoms of the practices, but may not mention the source of the difficulties that they're experiencing. And at the same time, in our research, most medical practitioners in Australia are not confident to raise questions about religion when clients present with issues. So the most important thing is for GPs and other practitioners to hold a curious openness to the way that religion might be involved in the problems that their patients are presenting with, and to create a safe space for the patients so that they can raise questions and seek help for resolving conflict that they may have between sexuality, gender identity, and religious or cultural belonging. So that might be a direct question, or it might just be a gentle, curious inquiry about, did religion have an impact on this situation?
The other thing that came up in our research, which relates, of course, to what we've been talking about people not necessarily understanding what informal conversion practices look like, is that patients themselves might not have the language to articulate their experiences in terms of conversion practices. So people might come in, as Tim said, sort of showing the symptoms or the damage done by what they've experienced, but not necessarily be connecting the dots themselves. So even being directly asked might not necessarily bring someone to be able to say, yeah, that happened to me. So really it's as Tim was saying about this, you know, an awareness and gently asking whether this might be something that's going on without necessarily assuming or having all the language to speak to it in a neat way.
For example, when we were doing the training, the awareness training with health practitioners last year, several of the practitioners had realizations during the training that they had experienced conversion practices, but they hadn't coded it that way in their mind. So it's a very, the sort of misinformation about this area is really profound. It's really important to be open to the impact that religion might have on a patient's presenting circumstances. And if a person does disclose that they've had some conversion practices, or they disclose conflict between their religious or cultural background and their sexuality or gender identity, having an awareness that they might need support with complex PTSD, they might need a health professional, a mental health provider who's able to deal with complex trauma, who's able to deal in a really sensitive and aware way about religious and cultural difference. I think that's pretty good.
If the presenting issues appear as a kind of, you know, potentially complex PTSD, then you're looking for a provider who's going to be able to work with patients around PTSD, but who's also obviously going to be sensitive to both sexuality and also faith. So we certainly heard from survivors of conversion practices that they had experiences whereby they might have found a therapist or a psychologist or someone to work with who was very supportive of their sexuality but didn't necessarily understand why they continued to hold on to faith or why it was still an important part of their life. And equally, you can certainly find practitioners who are very good working around mental health issues and PTSD who don't necessarily have an understanding of sexuality and issues related to sexuality. So it is sort of a tricky balance, but that's partly our objective, I guess, about raising awareness and having conversations, because there's certainly plenty of good mental health practitioners out there who would be fantastic at working with these patients and open and curious and willing to learn about these issues as they're working with a patient. You know, people don't necessarily have to be experts from the outset to be helpful.
Tim, if you had all the money and power and time in the world, what would you like to see happen straight away?
I think it would be really great for there to be resources for health providers to get better equipped, to get more confident, to deal with religious trauma, to be better equipped to deal with the complexity of religious trauma as it intersects with sexuality and gender diversity, and particularly for the extra complications for people who come from minority cultural backgrounds where there are different resources and different challenges, and the navigation of this conflict between religion and sexuality might require a different set of supports.
What about you, Jen?
This is such a complicated issue involving so many different parts of the community. So essentially, if we were really going to implement the full program to support survivors, we're talking about individuals who've experienced conversion practices, but also their family and their relationship with their family is implicated here, their relationship with their community, their relationship with their faith community. And so we're sort of talking about programs, you know, to build understanding within religious and faith organizations and communities, supports for families, awareness within families, broader awareness within communities. So, you know, there's been a lot of push for law reform, and that's been really significant and really important. But obviously the civil supports that surround any law reform are really important, because if laws change and the issue's suddenly on the public agenda and more people are recognising or starting to have a different understanding or being more willing to talk about their experiences of conversion practices, there's just got to be somewhere for people to go to be able to seek help. And so investment in training so that health practitioners are prepared and able and confident to ask questions about religion, to ask questions about sexuality, to support people to make the right referrals is just really important. And it's fundamental. It's a fundamental part of any law reform process around these issues.
Is this something medical schools should be looking at in terms of their curricula?
The fact that most of the health professionals that we spoke to lacked confidence to deal with religious trauma or complexities around religion speaks to a need for basic training in this area.
Jen, you said you thought sexuality should be more of a curriculum subject.
Look, I think understanding of sexuality and gender diversity should be a fairly fundamental part of medical training. You know, just because it's a you know, unique experience, there's no way GPs aren't going to be working at some time in their career with people who are LGBTQA+. Just mention people who identify as asexual or ACE, sometimes referred to, just because it is noted in the paper, and we did have asexual identified participants in our sample in as part of our study. And I think some people don't necessarily understand why asexuality would be a problem for religion. And so we certainly had people speaking to us about how in their religious community, as a person who identified as asexual, they felt a lot of pressure to not be that. to be attracted to someone of the opposite sex, to adhere to conventional heterosexual expectations to get married. And also that they didn't find a lot of support anywhere. So that was coming from within their religious community, within their family. And then if they sort of spoke to other people in the secular world, I guess, about asexuality, there was a lot of, yeah, but what happened to you? Why don't you want to have sex coming at them? Yeah. So just, I guess, a general misunderstanding of asexuality was something that came up, you know, in our study. And I think relates to conversion practices, but also relates to what you asked us before about, you know, how it sits across both religion and other parts of the community. In response to the law reform in Victoria, there were people, not necessarily GPs by any account, you know, who were concerned that it would now be a criminal offence to have conversations with patients about gender or sexuality.
Yeah.
And if there were GPs who had particular religious views, there might be concerns that having these, we're saying have these conversations and they might be feeling like that's threatening.
For people based in Victoria, the Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission is mandated under the Change and Suppression Act to provide education and facilitation services. So if people are unsure about the advice that they're giving, people based in Victoria can seek assistance there. Other states have health complaints commissioners and other statutory bodies who might be able to give advice as well.
Thank you both. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.